Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
We're talking football as we do every day at this time with the professor, John Clayton. Hello, John.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Fourth and 15. What happened? Jim was so excited, and I can tell you he's not very excited now. They pulled it off the table. What happened?
Not enough support. And that's. I remember when I was talking yesterday, I was worried when they added that one page that was so confusing, because they do this all the time. They put so much extra language in there, and they were talking about, what if there's a penalty? What do they do here and all that stuff? And it's like, come on. It's a one play, fourth and 15. You put it at the 25, and then, you know, if you don't make the play, then that's it. But then they had to worry about, do you call the timeout, or how do you stop play? How do you get the guys on the field? And so it had more support this year than it did last year, but it only was able to garner 16 votes, and you need 24 to be able to get in. So it looks like it's going to have to go on the hopper for next year and see if they can do it. But I think it's a disappointment, because when you look at the big picture, you know, and the 2 years that they've changed the rules, and I know that Dave Wyman's upset about this because they're trying to protect the returner and give him more of a chance to at least not get drilled and get a concussion. But what ends up happening is that on the onside kick, there was 114 over a two-year period. 10.5% of them were successful, but none of them, zero. In fact, of the 114 that were done, when you're trailing in the fourth quarter, not one time did an onside kick lead to a comeback. Now, again, we saw it with the Seahawks. That worked, but it was in the playoffs. But in the last 2 years since they changed the rules, you're 0 for 104 trying an onside kick that you can maybe grab and then get the lead.
And I'm sorry, John, you had some stats on 4th and 15s?
Was yeah, 4th and 15, that's 12.5% last year.
Okay. And you know, like Bob said, I mean, if you still have the option, I mean, and I would like the option to be, you know, the overload and be able to, you know, do the old onside kick rather than the new one, because the new one's even worse. But I don't know, it just kind of came off as gimmicky a little bit. I'll admit I'm starting to come around on it a little bit. It's just kind of strange. It just doesn't follow the normal flow of a football game.
No, you're right about that, but that's the, you know, again, it's like you want the ability to come back and then to not even have it, and you have now the useless, I'd say, onside kick under the new way. It's just kind of now a waste of time to even think about it, because, again, yes, you want all the elements to give your team a chance to come back, right? Because one of the great parts, and you've watched it now since 2012, how good Russell Wilson is at being able to come back. But if you can generate the excitement of maybe, you know, converting that 4th and 15 and then getting a drive going. I thought that Danny Cannell, the former backup quarterback, had probably the best comment that I know Wyman's going to love. It's like, oh, so you're telling me that they decided that it's better not to have what might be the most exciting play in sports in a critical time in a game and letting some sappy kicker go on the field. So it's like, oh, okay. Actually, he said nerdy kicker. Well, nerdy kicker.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, well, Professor, how come they table things? Why don't they just let it go to a vote? If the owners vote it down, then just, you know, reconsider it next year. I was disappointed in that. The sky judge. Mm-hmm. You get this big buildup for these potential new rules, and then it's like, bleh, you know, just blah.
Yeah, a virtual owners meeting, which was offering virtually nothing. I mean, just really minor rule changes. But no, I agree, because, you know, they did advance one little thing, but it's not all that great, but at least it's a little bit of an advancement. Instead of doing this sky judge, because they don't even want to call it the sky judge, they want to have, you know, booth assist or something like that. What they're going to do, instead of hiring an eighth official, is that at least in the preseason, test it out, if there is a preseason, that what you can do is that you have the replay official that can be in communication a lot more with the referee. So if he sees something, he can kind of communicate it. But again, he can't overrule anything. He can't make a ruling. All he can do is just assist the referee. The referee would have total control of this. And so they're going to maybe try that out in the preseason and see how it goes.
If you have questions for the professor, you can text them into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Any questions you've got on the NFL, we'll try to get to some of those. John, we didn't dig deep into this. We're going to get into it later in the show, but I wanted to get your thoughts. Bob Condotta wrote a story about the Seahawks and kind of looked at each position group and you know, saying whether they've improved, not, and they're the same or they're worse. And two of the main ones he identified as being worse, just as we sit now and acknowledging we haven't seen these guys play yet, defensive line and the offensive line. Looks at both of them and says they are worse currently as we stand than they were last year. What do you think?
I tend to disagree because, you know, I think that, you know, again, certainly if you're looking at the beginning of the season and you had Justin Britt, yeah, I mean, you don't have the improvement there. But I think B.J. Finney's going to be an okay player. And I think that Brandon Shell can actually come back and actually outperform Jermaine Ifedi. I mean, think about the idea that, you know, here he ends up getting a two-year deal at $9 million, and Ifedi on the open market, after 4 years of starting, could only get the minimum salary. What does that say? And, you know, you don't have the mistakes that Ifedi made. Again, Ifedi was not a bust. I mean, he started for 4 years, did not miss many games, and, you know, was always available. But the penalties that he had and some of the bad blocking on pass plays, that hurt. And so I think Shell's going to be an upgrade, and we'll see where it goes with Damian Lewis. I mean, because, again, it's like you still would have felt safer with, you know, DJ Fluker. But, you know, I think they're going to try to go young. And they also needed to get a little bit younger because they were getting to that stage where, you know, you're going to have the average age of the starting offensive lineman at 30 years old. And that's a bad number to go. So I think, you know, Damian Lewis can try to learn things very quickly. You can see that Dwayne Brown, at least from his press conference yesterday, seems to be in good spirits, so that's encouraging. So I think that overall, I think that the offensive line is going to be better. And still, you have the questions on the defensive line, and that's legit. But, you know, the positive things is now you have Jaron Reed for an entire season. You have four options at the Leo position. You have two options at the five technique. You still have the outside chance, you know, a limited chance that Jadeveon Clowney can come back. And, you know, they just have need to add one more run-stopping defensive lineman. Like, for example, if Al Woods was available, and, of course, he's now in Jacksonville, would that make the line a little bit better? Because he was a pretty good run-stopper.
Yeah, hey, John, a question from the 503, and this might be our buddy Jen from Beaverton, but what makes the team resistant, seemingly anyway, to signing Everson Griffin? Tell us the story on Everson Griffin again, because, you know, really good player.
Yeah,
he played really well up here against the Seahawks on Monday Night Football, and but yet he had, like, some kind of a breakdown at one point. He missed some games. What's
Yeah, he just had a bad mental breakdown in the 2018 season, and I think maybe that's why there's a little bit of a reticence to try to do anything with him, because, I mean, clearly he's the next option, and I'm sure that at this stage he can come in at a very reasonable price. But I think there's maybe just a little bit of the fear that, okay, could those problems rise again? And, you know that Pete Carroll knows him. He coached him in college, so there's a knowledge there, but there just seems to be a resistance to do something like that. And plus, I mean, I think he would be – wouldn't he be fitting more of the five technique than the Leo?
Yeah.
And I think that they really do want to give LJ Collier the chance, because I know that, you know, there was times that the coaches just didn't get him on the field as much as they probably could. You know, again, so much of that had to be the injuries in training camp that set him back. But, you know, I think that, you know, again, sometimes it's not bad to get younger. But again, there's still the question mark, because there's so many things you just don't know. And then, you know, you still have the ability to see what might pop free at some point.
Collier's doing a Zoom news conference with reporters, local reporters here tomorrow, John. How optimistic are you for his 2020 season?
I'm reasonably optimistic because I think he's a good player. I mean, that's the one thing, you know, talking to his college coaches and that. I mean, you know, he's got a good bull rush. You know, he's a good student of the game. It was just the injury that kind of slowed him down and put him behind, and then he really couldn't beat out anybody else, even though, again, I think that sometimes you get into practice and you just can't get the opportunity. But I think that I think he has a good chance to get better. Because, again, you know, say what you want. They always say, okay, well, geez, they took him a little bit higher than expected. Well, he was a second-round great, right? And that's John Schneider. Because, again, it's like, okay, so you keep trading down, you get more value, then you're able to trade up and get, you know, a couple of the guys like DK Metcalf that you really hit on. And then, you know, Collier looks, well, yeah, they took him. He should have waited into the second round. Well, again, they didn't want to take all their draft choices and put him in the second round. And so at some point, particularly the way that draft was going, you know, the pass rushers were going so fast that, you know, you would run out by the time you would get into the second round, and you wouldn't have gotten an LJ Collier. So I think that I think he has a chance to come on and do some good things.
Again, if you've got questions for John, just text him into 710-710 to the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll get to your questions coming up. John, we were talking about the people out there, as Jim likes to call them, the cooking people. Let Russ cook. They want to see him throw the ball more, put the game in his hands more. I'm not on board with that, but what I am on board with is picking up the tempo here and there, mixing that up, because they get in this, it feels like a rut where they drain the clock down, and I understand there's a philosophy behind that, but I think it makes them a little more predictable for the defense. They allow them to get set up. You don't really keep them on their toes, so to speak. What would you think about them not throwing the ball more,
yeah,
but maybe mixing in, you know, some tempo early in the game, not at the end when they're behind, not at the end of a half, but early in the game?
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. In some ways, I think you can see there was a little bit more of that last year than there certainly was in Brian Schottenheimer's first year. But I think, you know, it's not like you have to go all the way to no huddle and anything else, because, again, if you can't get the running game going and you can't get that good first down gain, then all of a sudden you're giving the ball back to the other team and on a three and out in like about 90 seconds, and that's not good. But I think that mixing it up, and, you know, you saw a little bit of that in the Pittsburgh game in week two, because you knew that Pittsburgh was going to do those blitzes, and so they did some different tempo things like that. And I think that particularly, you know, in year three of Brian Schottenheimer's offense, you can definitely, you want to be a little bit more unpredictable. But again, I think the key is, I mean, you don't want to pass too much, because I think that you can see when Russell passes, you know, more than, say, gets under pass plays. And I, again, include pass plays because you have to include the 48 and 51 sacks of the last couple of years. You know, that's on a pass play. But I think if you can just, you know, manage it so you can not go over 35 pass attempts a game and get your 30 runs, you're doing well. Because this team was number four running the football, but and that's number four, knowing that at the end of the season, they were down their top three running backs.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Pittsburgh game, John. I was just looking at that because people are saying, you know, be more aggressive in the first half. And I was asking for examples of how they were being conservative. And in that game, Russ ended up throwing it 35 times in that game. I think he was 28 for 35, but mm-hmm. he threw 19 times in the first half. And the problem was, as you mentioned, I think he got sacked either three or four times in that first half.
Right.
But, you know, they were still trying to be aggressive there. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's more passes in the first half than the second half. If my math is correct, 19 plus 16 is 35.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm usually hesitant to do radio math, but yeah, it just to me it just seems like that's something, you know, and I can't explain it. And I think what people try to do is they try to connect dots and say, well, they obviously weren't being more aggressive. Well, I'm not so sure about that, because, you know, and I'm kind of working on that right now as we're going here, just seeing, you know, how many times he threw it in the first half versus the second half, and it's not that far off, you know, as far as being, you know, a little bit more as far as, you know, how many passes in the first half. And it's just, I don't know, how would you explain it? I mean, it just seems like that's the personality of this team. I've always thought with Bevel, and that was different, that they would just kind of rope-a-dope for the first half, kind of figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not a good term, but then, you know, they're just this heck of a great, good, you know, comeback team. But yeah, as far as getting off to the early starts, I understand why people are saying that, you know, because it does look that way, and it does, like, why is it that way with this team?
Well, I guess because, again, it's probably the problems that they've had on the offensive line the last couple of years. Because what happens is, you know, if you start to do too much passing early, then you get the three and outs, and then you're really going to be in trouble. And then, you know, more than anything else, I mean, where you look at you've studied the stats as far as the only five games that they had where they had the lead at the half, and, you know, they were 3-4. In trailing at the half, or in games at home, or having to tie one time, you know, one time they had a tie at the half. And so it's still the defense because the defense still did not get the sacks. And, of course, part of that was they're always trying to come back from a halftime lead or halftime trailing. And then, Russell ended up throwing more passes in the fourth quarter than any other quarter in the game. And that's so much because he's maybe down by 3, down by 7, down by 10. And all you can do is just try to pass to get yourself back in the game. Now, I think it's a matter that you want to try to start out as best you can, as early as you can, and then you hope the defense has improved enough that you have the lead at halftime, because you know how good they are when they have that 4-point lead under Pete Carroll. And so that's, I think, it's the as much as we talk about the offense, it's the defense that needs to tighten things up more.
John, we have a question from Reese in the 253. How realistic is this? San Francisco finishes first in the NFC West, Arizona second, Seattle third, the Rams fourth, and all finish above 500.
I think there is a chance. I mean, the only thing that's going to hold that back, the only way that can happen is that the division game split. So in other words, and that's happened before, where every team goes 3-3 in the division, and then you're talking about going six and four outside the division and trying to do it that way. I mean, there's a chance, because at least this division can be good enough, because even though the Rams have lost so much on defense, they're still a good enough team, and they also lost Gurley and Cooks on offense. And Arizona, I think, is the most improved team in football right now, with a quarterback who I think is going to really be good. And somebody asked me this morning to rank the quarterbacks in this division, and obviously Russell Wilson's number one. In a close vote, I have Jimmy Garoppolo 2, and then Jared Goff 3, and then Murray starting out the season 4. But my guess is by the end of the season, Murray's going to be 2, because I think he's that good. And he may not have as big of a jump as Lamar Jackson, but I think he's going to have a big jump.
John, the 360 wants to know, if Josh Gordon does come back to the Seahawks, where would you rank their receiving crew in the amongst the rest of the NFL teams?
You'd have to say top 10, because now you have a Pro Bowl caliber guy who's now definitely in the top 10 in the league, and Tyler Lockett. Then you've got DK Metcalf, who's now one of the rising young stars in the league. Gordon's really talented. Philip Dorsett is really speedy, and it's a former first-round pick. We'll see how it goes for John Ursua and David Moore and all those guys. But I think that it's a pretty good group, because now when you're starting to talk about, Philip Dorsett's now going to be the 4 guy possibly, with Gordon maybe being 3, that's a pretty talented group. It's not the best, but it's going to be pretty good.
Hey, John, I was listening today. I can't remember if it was Matt LaFleur, head coach of the Packers, live, or they were talking about how he was talking to Aaron Rodgers 4 times a week, leading up to the draft and everything. I'm not sure I bought that, but, he was trying to explain to Aaron Rodgers, that, hey, look, he was a couple guys went before, and he was the best player, and we grabbed him, and I just don't see any way that at the end of that conversation, Aaron Rodgers is like, yeah, okay, coach, yeah, I get you. Yeah, I understand now. It just doesn't square up for me.
Well, Brett Favre talked to Aaron right after the draft and asked Aaron the direct question, did anybody tell you in Green Bay that they were going to draft or trade up? Because it wasn't a matter that he was the best player on the board. They had to trade up and give up value to move up to the pick to get Love. And so when the answer came from Aaron, he's like, no, they didn't hear from him. It's like, no, did not know whatsoever. So they may have talked 4 times a week, but they didn't talk about what ended up being something that's going to constantly irritate Aaron Rodgers. And so you can talk a good game, but they didn't talk and pull the quarterback in on the equation. And then on top of it, they didn't get him any wide receivers. And they didn't even get him a tight end.
There's someone available that might help Green Bay out. That's Percy Harvin. He turned 32 today, John. If you want to sing happy birthday to him, if you have his cell phone, is there any chance that Percy Harvin's going to land with a team? Because he was working out. He looked like he was in good shape. Some of those Instagram videos that he was posting. What do you think?
I tend to doubt it. Because he's been out of the game long enough, and you're at the stage right now where the guys that have been out a couple years, it's really hard for them to get back in. And the problems that he had when he was playing, I'd say right now, very limited to no chance he's going to get back on a team.
Hey, John, what's the feeling about Dwayne Haskins in Washington? I mean, he's only had 1 year. He wasn't great last year, had a little mess up there on the sideline. But I keep reading conflicting stories about him, one saying, Washington doesn't have the faith in him and they're going to be looking elsewhere. And then I see another story where Scott Turner, their offensive coordinator, saying, man, he's doing a great job with the virtual meetings and he's speaking the language. What's the true impression of him out there in Washington?
It's probably sketchy because, again, like all these coaches, you haven't seen him on the field. And so you're kind of guessing as to what he's going to be able to do. And that's why Ron Rivera, was able to make the trade and get for a fifth-round pick, Kyle Allen to come in just in case. Because at least Kyle knows the system because he's been down there for 2 years in Carolina with Rivera. And, of course, with Scott Turner and, of course, North Turner, who was the offensive coordinator, although he's not doing it anymore. But I think that I still hold out good hopes for Haskins. It's going to be tough with no off season for him working with the team, because that if you go into your first year, it's I wouldn't say impossible, very difficult to think you're going to be overly successful. And if you only have the first year, you have no chance to correct yourself. And he's not been able to go on the field and correct any of the issues. So I think he's going to struggle. They're not a real good offensive team. But, it's one where I still think he can be a pretty good quarterback, but I think it may take him to year three.
What do you think about Carolina? You mentioned him, Ron Rivera, and then, Kyle Allen, which is weird because when you go to his website on ESPN, there's a Washington Redskin logo behind him.
Well, yeah, they traded for him, remember?
Kyle Allen. That's right. Okay, I'm sorry.
And by the way, have you heard about the Drew Brees contract?
I screwed that one up, John. But he was okay last year. But they had a pretty good draft there too, and a new coach with Matt Rhule. And I liked their draft. What do you think about their chances this year?
It's going to be I think they're putting together a good fast offense. I mean, that they've got the $16 million running back in Christian McCaffrey. I think that they were able to add a lot of speed at the wide receiver position in the last 2 years. So I think offensively, they have a chance to be okay. But the defense, I mean, they've had so many changes. And that's where I think it's going to hold them back. And so, because they had to get rid of so many guys. I mean, they lose James Bradbury, their best cornerback. Luke Kuechly retired. There's so many things working against them there. But I think that, what you're looking at is a team that probably is going to win six games. Maybe if they're lucky, they get seven games. Because, clearly they're the fourth team right now in the NFC South.
And how is John, Drew good Brees' stuff. Contract, by the way?
What's that? 2 years, $50 million. For Drew Brees.
Okay, thank you.
It's a pretty good contract. No. John, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
There you go. If you missed any of today's Cold Hard Facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Just how bad are things between Major League Baseball and the Players Association? Can they get to a place where we're going to actually see baseball this season? We'll discuss that with John Morosi. He's going to join us next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
We love talking baseball with this guy. You catch him on Major League Baseball Network, also Fox Sports, and he is with us every other week. John Morosi is here. John, how are you, man?
Bob, Dave, Jim, I am doing well, my friends. Hope all of you and your families are doing great, as well as all of our great listeners in Seattle. And let's hope that good news arrives here in the next week or so for baseball.
Yeah, well, we want to get into that, certainly. But I want to get a quick thought from you on the Oakland A's, because I was taking shots at them earlier. I saw tweets from Jeff Passan talking about their decision not to pay their minor leaguers their $400 a week stipend, where I think Passan did the math saying it would cost them about $5,200 per player to pay them that through June, July, and August. And it saves them just over $1 million, where their owner, John Fisher, is worth an estimated $2 billion. And then John Heyman added on to that, saying, the real salt in the wound is that they remain A's employees, just unpaid employees, meaning they cannot seek free agency and they cannot file for unemployment. How different is what the A's are doing compared to the other teams in the league?
Well, it does seem pretty unique among the different approaches that are being taken right now. Every team is doing it differently, of course, and it does seem that for now a lot of teams are continuing to still take care of their minor leaguers in some capacity. But you're right that, unfortunately, as is the case for society at large, the pain of this economically is felt the most by those who are on the lowest end of the wage scale. And that in baseball includes minor leaguers. And at this point in time, we don't really know when minor league baseball will be able to resume in any sort of normal fashion. And I think that's why teams are handling this differently. Unfortunately, this is, I think, one of the more extreme examples, but I think on a large level, it will affect those minor league players financially and also their overall well-being. And I think Jeff Passan noted this as well today, that this, the number of players that are just simply being released. You're seeing a lot of dreams ending right now, and the chances for them to then find other employment playing baseball are also quite limited around the U.S. and around the world as well, because the leagues are simply in a bit of a holding pattern all over the place. And I think eventually this will obviously have a big effect on the way that minor leagues develop all around Major League Baseball, the way that the overall chemistry is built for different teams. I think, unfortunately, the minor league players, even those that remain with the A's for the long term, I think there will be an enduringly negative legacy of this decision that really could have dramatic ramifications on just the workplace chemistry of the baseball clubhouse at the minor league level for that organization now for a long time to come.
Yeah, I thought it was just a bad business move by the A's, really, just as far as, you know, perception and their fan base and everybody. But being a guy like you, that you love baseball, obviously, you're hoping that, you know, if there's some ugly negotiations, they get back playing, that it's going to be soon forgotten, or do you think this is going to be something that has a hangover for years to come?
Well, it's a really good question, because I really think there's a lot to look at here with baseball. We realize that there has to be a negotiation to simply have baseball this season. And then there's another one coming whenever, I think certainly this season is over. We'll see how different teams handle their spending in the coming off season, which is, of course, is not that far away from us right now. And then to larger extent, we've got the CBA negotiation coming up following the 2021 season. So it really is a series of decisions that have to be made at a large level for the sport, where I think there will be a period of healing where you see the game get back on the field. That's going to be a really great positive thing. I still believe it's going to happen. But there's this notion of why haven't we had a chance to really develop and deal with the more substantial economic issues. I think that probably is the next question of if there ends up being some sort of long-lasting labor stoppage or haggling over the next CBA, that could have, I think, more of an enduringly negative impact on things. I say all that, though, and I have to add this. This is still the sport with the longest period of labor peace. I know it doesn't feel like it right now, but this is still a sport that's had labor peace since 1995, and that counts for something. It should count for something, and my hope is that an agreement next week will happen, and then there will be a lot of positivity surrounding the game returning to the field.
All right, John Paul, if I'm out on the mound, should I be throwing bean balls at the players or the owners?
Well, Jim, to me, here's how I look at it, and you're right that the fact that we're talking about this at this stage in the midst of a pandemic is obviously not great for the game on all sides, and that has to be said. I still believe that we should, on some level, withhold our sharpest judgment for the next week, because I think that if there's an agreement by the early part of next week, then everything is basically still on schedule, and you're going to have still an agreement in place. You'll have the games able to start playing in the early part of July, we would hope, as you're hearing my seven-year-old talk behind me. I think that the fact that you're probably going to have the agreement in place, and then, you know, I believe some degree of this will be forgiven, but I also think that there has to be a larger understanding of maybe the economic realities of both sides of this. I think the players, there is something to be said for them and what they're doing and how they're approaching things. But I think overall the clubs, they have to realize that they're losing basically 40% of their revenues from a standpoint of their not having any gate. And I think that is a real overriding consideration of the latest proposal from MLB on Tuesday. And we have to just wait and see what the overall comprehensive plan is from the union here in response in the next 24 hours or so.
So, John, before we let you go, what is your level of optimism, seeing as it looks like that Major League Baseball presented an offer to the players that you knew the second you read it was a non-starter, and they obviously treated it as such, and now you read the proposal they're going to send back to Major League Baseball coming from the union, and you look at it and go, I don't see the union even giving this a sniff. This looks like a non-starter. I understand it's negotiation, but where is your level of optimism in terms of a season actually happening?
Still high, and here's why. So we saw the original thought from MLB was the possibility of revenue sharing, a 50-50 split, and the players said effectively through the media and different statements made that no, that was not going to work because that amounts to a salary cap. I was encouraged that the first MLB offer did not include that revenue sharing because that was, as you point out, even more of a non-starter than this. This is at least in the same rhetorical area of the way that the agreement always has been in the past, which is there's no salary cap, and it's just a matter of scaling back and effectively moving those percentages along the continuum. Right now, the players, clearly they don't want to have the agreement that MLB proposed on Tuesday. I understand that, based on their response initially. But they also would probably accept some further rollback if it's not too big here in the days ahead. So at least you're still talking on the same plane of not having a salary cap and not having a strict revenue share. It's just a matter of finding the right number along the continuum. And I believe wherever that compromise point is, I believe they're going to find it. I know it doesn't sound optimistic at the moment, but I still believe there's enough of a commonality there. And the other part is you could potentially adjust the number of games being played. That's been mentioned too. The players want more games played. And the ability to revenue share at least off of the playoff revenues. That is the key anxiety point for the owners. Not knowing if there's going to be a postseason is the thing that's really working against MLB because they simply don't know what the overall revenue is going to be because the part of the playoffs and the postseason that brings them the most revenue is the part that's theoretically at the greatest risk because of a second spike of COVID-19. So that, to me, being able to give players more revenue of the playoffs, I think that's a potentially really significant part of this, maybe deferring some salary. There's a lot of different aspects of this that I still think could potentially get negotiated out here in the days ahead. So I'm still saying, guys, very optimistic and that we will see, hopefully, baseball played here by the middle part of July.
Awesome. John, we appreciate the optimism and always appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much. Enjoy your time with your 7-year-old there, and we'll talk to you soon.
You're hearing now the perils of even they behaved themselves while I was on the air earlier today. But as you know, guys, when your kids are 7, 5, and 2, to expect them to behave themselves through the entire day is probably not going to happen. So apologies for the background noise, but they want baseball to come back too, so that way Dad can travel a little bit more often, I think.
Yeah, we appreciate it, John.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, John Paul.
Have a great night. Thank you.
There you go. John Morosi from Major League Baseball Network and Fox Sports. Always good to talk to him.
I'm aware,
Jim. All next week, 710 ESPN Seattle will celebrate Mariners Legends Week with interviews with Mariners Hall of Famers and all-time greats across all of our shows. So Danny and Gallant, John Clayton, Tom, Jake, and Stacy right here with Bob, Dave, and more. We'll have different Mariner legends on all week long. Don't miss a single moment. You can follow along on air, online, or with the 710 Sports app. So really, really cool week coming up. Check that out starting next week. Meanwhile, Dan Orlovsky and Damian Lillard have gotten into it. Orlovsky called Lillard spoiled and entitled for his comments about a return to play in the NBA. We're going to hear more about that when we sweep the dial. Coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
We were in the middle of a playoff race, you know, a pretty tight playoff race, not just with us, but, you know, the 10th, 11th, and 12th place teams in the Western Conference are, you know, within striking distance. And you're looking at 15, 16 games remaining, and you got an opportunity to close in. So now with these things happening, you just would hope that when we do come back and play, that you have an opportunity to still be in pursuit of that instead of just coming back and playing just to play. You know, that's not that's not what anybody wants. And again, we want to play, man, but we want to play for something, just like everybody else that's going to play for something. Man.
I struggle with sitting there going, how can you sit there and go, nope, I'm not going to play, but understand that there's people out there that don't have that choice, that they have to go to work and they have to go earn their money. I struggle with sitting here and going, you don't come off as a spoiled and entitled brat by saying, I'm not going to play.
Uh-oh. First voice you heard was Damian Lillard of the Trailblazers, and then the second voice was ESPN's Dan Orlovsky calling him spoiled and entitled, and then it took to Twitter. That's when you know it's serious. It goes to Twitter. They started going back and forth with each other, and Lillard tweeted, entitled and spoiled? MF, watch your mouth. My background, family, and character couldn't be further from entitled and spoiled. I said what I said. And then he was bashing Orlovsky for being a career backup in the NFL, saying, you sat out your whole career, basically. And then Orlovsky sort of backpedaled, saying, you're right, I shouldn't have used those words, brat and entitled and spoiled. So he apologized for using those words. I think he sticks to his point, but he apologized for using those choice words that Damian Lillard took offense to.
Kind of funny, you know, just the use of language. Like, there's people that text in these things, and there's lots of times where I'll text in and say, did you read your text before you sent it? I mean, is there anything that makes you think I'm not going to get irritated by this? Or but you know, as an
ESPN their goal.
Guy or whatever, you know, you're supposed to say those kinds of inflammatory things, right? I mean, I don't want to say this is a win for Dan Orlovsky, but I mean, now we're talking about him, and it's something that's inflammatory, but you probably should have looked at it first. Entitled and spoiled, you call somebody that? I mean, and I'm not entirely sure of Lillard's background, but I know Russ likes him. It's Damian Lillard, right? I think he calls him Dame. Or something. I think Russ and him are friends.
Well, okay, maybe you guys can fill in the blanks here. Isn't Damian Lillard under contract to play for the Portland Trailblazers? And
yes.
I think when you're under contract, it doesn't matter whether you're in playoff position or not. And if I'm Lillard, I'm looking at my contract going, what's this? I'm making $196 million over 4 years? Well, sure, I'll trot my ass out there to play for that. So I got to say, I side with Dan Orlovsky, and if he wants to rip him, you know, Lillard with his comeback about him being crummy, and he was a backup quarterback. He's a hell of a commentator, though, I think. And yeah, so I'm put me on Dan Orlovsky's team on this one.
I have a different approach to this year. You know, I think it's everybody that has been interviewed in our team has kind of, you know, hit the nail on the head over and over. About, you know, it's just time to work. It's time to do our thing instead of talking about it. So this is the first media thing I've done just because there's no need to be talking about it. It's just time to go do it. And right now it's, you know, kind of moving in silence, which is fine with me. It's how I used to do it before getting on a bigger stage. So I'm happy to get back to those roots. And like I said earlier, get back to the fundamentals to where I can accomplish the goals when the season comes around.
Well, if you're a Cleveland Browns fan, you love hearing that. That's your quarterback, Baker Mayfield, who's been anything but quiet in his first couple of years in the league and, you know, had a promising first year and then fell on his face last year when they went 6-10 after going 7-8-1 in the first year. He turned the ball over. I think he had 21 interceptions, and that would have been horrific if not for Jameis Winston throwing 30 on the season. But, yeah, bad year for Baker, and maybe he's growing up. Maybe he's going to turn into a leader. Maybe he'll become what everybody believes he can be. I don't think anybody's debated his talent. It was more about his attitude and ego getting in the way. And I think if you're a Browns fan, hearing that should make you feel better.
Yeah, well, and this one's for you, Jim. If I was Baker Mayfield, I would have said, I'm going to talk less this year. The end. That was a lot of talking for somebody who's not going to talk.
I don't know why, but I'm still pulling for Baker Mayfield. Just No great reason, but don't you think? I mean, there's not as much hype in Cleveland this year, and don't you think they're going to be better? You look at the weapons that they have with OBJ and Jarvis Landry, Nick Chubb, Kareem Hunt, Baker Mayfield, and I like the idea of them having a new coach. And Bob, I know, I think it was yesterday you said, well, they have a new coach every year. But this guy, Kevin Stefanski, I think he came over from Minnesota. So, I have higher hopes for the Browns this year. And I'm pulling for Mayfield. Maybe he'll get it going this year.
I couldn't imagine, or I'm honest with you, the money that we get from the TV contract, the money that we get from the fans in the stadium fuels everything around here. Everything at our university, all the sports, all the facilities, the best thing that we can give to our football players. And as you know, Baton Rouge on a Saturday is hopping. They're tailgating, the restaurants are full, the hotels are full, the economy is booming. So it would be a big blow to not only our universities, but the economy. I do believe we need football.
There's nothing like gumbo after a big victory down in Baton Rouge.
That's right.
Coach Ogeron, we really enjoyed having you on the program. Our best to you and good luck this season.
Thank you. Go Tigers.
Just an excuse to hear him talk. Ed Ogeron talking about the need for football.
Need to play football out there. Funds everything.
It's he could sit there and read a book. I'd be sitting there smiling. I just like hearing the guy talk.
I saw this in the lineup. I was like, oh, this Bob had something to do with this. Hey, and
I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, yeah. The guy who says let's get ready to rumble, how much does he get paid for that?
Michael Buffer.
Yeah. Doesn't he get like? I heard some ridiculous thing. It was like $50,000 for an appearance or something like that.
He gets a lot of money, and he's got it trademarked to where like we couldn't play it on this show. We could if they found out, we could be in trouble. So he's done well with that line.
I think Ed Ogeron needs to follow that same path as Michael Buffer. That like just use his voice. You know, I mean, you advertisements, everything. It's comical.
I think it's comical too, and I've mentioned this before that USC could have had Ed Ogeron as their permanent coach instead of just an interim coach, and they passed on him, and they've been a fiasco ever since. And now Ogeron goes on to win the national championship at LSU, so good for him. And I'm with you guys; that makes three of us who you can't get enough of Ed Ogeron and his voice.
It's awesome. All right, coming up, it's time for our weekly check-in with our favorite and your favorite, Paul Moyer, to talk all things Seahawks. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.